hear ye.
The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We have with us... For indulging us in a sidebar conference, but not in its usual format. I want to welcome Fort Atkinson High School students who are here with us for this oral argument. Would you all stand, please? Good seeing you. You may be seated. These students are here with the Court with Class program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. It's a national award-winning program. Students from around the state are invited to join us for oral argument. If they accept, they're given briefs of the case they will hear, and they may engage in a variety of activities relating to the case. And as part of the program, the students will meet with the justice, usually at noon, and the discussion relates to the procedures of the court in hearing cases and deciding them, but not the substantive issues. Now, Justice Wilcox is scheduled today to make the presentation, but I gather the high school students can't and will not be here at noon. But Justice Wilcox will meet with you for a few moments after this case and before the second case, so you may stay. Let me first say that everyone is welcome to listen to the discussion between the students and Justice Wilcox. It is not limited to the Fort Atkinson High School students.
Could I invite my peers here also if you want to listen? You can.
If anyone wishes on the bench, you may. It is not required. Now I've gotten in the middle of this. You want to be introduced. That's where you are.
No.
I was going to do something else, and what I was going to say is if any of you here are not familiar with the case we're about to hear, the marshal has a summary of the facts and issues. If you raise your hand, she will give you a summary. All right. Now I'll introduce the court. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right is Justice Patrick Crooks, who was elected on Tuesday to another 10-year term. And on the far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. Let me call the next case, 03AP3348D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Michael D. Mandelman. Justice Crooks.
I would want to disclose on the record that Mr. Hildebrand was the treasurer of my campaign. And also I would want to disclose that Mr. Hildebrand and his wife hosted a victory party, even though we had no opposition, a victory party on election night. The victory party costs were picked up by the campaign, but I certainly want that on the record, and the record should note that five of the seven justices were present at that party. The Chief Justice and Justice Prosser were not. And certainly if OLR has any objection to me sitting or any of the other justices sitting on this case, we would certainly want you to note that, and I would recuse myself if there is any objection.
Counsel?
Okay.
Mr. Hildebrand? Do you have any objection?
Right.
I have to show that our mere fact that Justice Prosser and I did not go to the party does not mean that we don't party. Mr. Hildebrand, representing Michael D. Mandelman.
Yes,
may it please the court, I am here representing Michael Mandelman, and it's always a distinct privilege and high honor to appear before this court to argue a case. This case, I would like to devote most of my argument to the so-called SCR 25.1C2 issue in the case. And that 5.1C2 is a rule that under some circumstances will make one lawyer responsible for another lawyer's misconduct. One of the main problems, I think, with the way this case was tried and with the way it was decided is that it appeared to me in reading the record, I did not try the case, but it appeared to me in reading the record that it was tried as if it were a malpractice case, whereas a partner in a law firm, of course, would be automatically responsible for any malpractice or items causing damage to a client. And so you have language such as joint responsibility, joint representation, and the like. But this is not a malpractice case. This is not a case where liability can, under the rules of professional conduct, be imposed under a respondeat superior theory or a joint and several liability theory or other concepts of tort law which might make one partner liable for the breaches of contract or malpractice and tort of another lawyer. Rather, we have in the model rules, among them is 5.1C2, which outlines how a lawyer will be individually responsible. And 5.1C2 is the kind of a statute that outlines what must be proven in the case where there is responsibility for an ethical violation as opposed to being responsible for damages for malpractice. And it has three elements. The first element is that a partner or someone having direct supervisory authority over the lawyer, that's the first element. And here, to some extent, the OLR satisfied the first element. But the next element is knows of the conduct in time when its consequences can be avoided. That's the second element. And the third element is fails to take remedial action. If you look at the findings of the referee, I certainly was unable to determine that appropriate findings were made in any instance involving 5.1C2 where Mr. Mandelman knew of the conduct of REITs at the time when its consequences can be avoided or failed to take remedial action.
Mr. Hildebrand, I think that's probably you've raised one of the more interesting issues in lawyer discipline and one of the more interesting issues in the case. But you have a very, let us agree that partners as well as partners and associates in different firms have different methods of communicating, have different techniques of supervision, have different ways of handling clients and clients' files. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes.
Okay. In this firm, as I understand it, you have equal partners. So your argument is they don't supervise each other.
I think that's true as a matter of fact, too, in the record.
Okay.
But
well, I have real reservations about that. They agreed, as I understand it, that they would each work up the files, the same file, and work together on the file. A might do X, Y, and Z, and B might do C, D, and A. And that sometimes one would have the file and work on it, and sometimes the other one would have the file and work on it. And that your client was with some frequency, as far as the client was concerned, was the lead counsel and was the counsel working on the case and may or may not know what the other partner did.
The client would not know what the other partner said, what you're saying. Okay.
I mean, I think that's, at least as I read it, that is clear. So let's just take the
May I just say this? It's not that clear that the client wouldn't know. For example, in our brief, we cited numerous exhibits where the client was communicating directly. So I'm sorry to interrupt, but
I accept that. I think that's true. And it goes back to my first part of the statement of, as I understand the facts, mainly both would work on the file. And the client would sometimes know both were on the file, sometimes would not, but both were working the file. Take the one where there was a release. Your client told his partner to make sure that if he was going to do a deposition, if Manuel was going to do a deposition, the client would concede or state that he was happy with what Mandelman was doing. What does that mean? To me, when you say happy, if he wants a letter saying, I'm happy with everything you've done a terrific job for me so far, keep up the good work, go take the deposition. Where would you use that I am a happy letter?
Well,
if it wasn't for ultimately if the client was said unhappy, you'd use it and say, now you're unhappy. Then you were perfectly happy, and that's a release of all of it. Now, it's not as good as a release, but maybe it's better than a release because a release would be suspect
and right.
Invalid.
Let me answer your question with two statements. First of all, the release issue is not involved with respect to my 5.1c2 argument. The 5.1c2 argument involves and I'll just cite one of these, the Colpack case, for example, where REITs didn't pay attention and a judgment was taken against the client by a health care provider. And there was no evidence in this record that Mr. Mandelman knew or ever heard about this judgment, yet the referee held him liable under 5.1c2, okay? Now I will get to the release issue which you raised. There are no 5.1c issues with respect to Ms. Crosby or that entire thing. The release question that you raised is simply this. The facts are totally basically not in conflict, and it is our contention that we, with respect to the release, Mr. Reitz went above and beyond the call of duty, so to say, and had this client execute a document which unfortunately was in violation of the rules. And the question that this court has to face is that on this record, with Mandelman never seeing the release and it just going into the file, is he somehow liable for this? We claim that there has to be some kind of a knowledge or...
Oh, that's a C2.
No, that's 1.8H, I believe.
I have a, just to follow up, same vein, but the opposing counsel makes the issue of the fact that in Klopak, in I think it's Owsley and Krause case, Mandelman was retained. He, in other words, he was the lawyer that was retained by the client. Now, does that make any difference in your argument where in a two-person office or whatever it is, they come in and they retain the person, and the fact that I think the point is made that one or more of the clients contacted Mandelman directly wanting to know what happens to their case. So you have the retainer, you have the contact. Does that give more responsibility to Mr. Mandelman because he was retained by that person to do a certain job, which he then farmed out to his partner, Reitz?
He is responsible under tort law for any miscues. But if one wants to impose liability under 5.1C2, then there has to be knowledge. And one of the most troubling aspects of this case, and however you the court decides it when this opinion is written, to me one of the most troubling aspects of this case is that we have a situation where the OLR is talking about differences between small firms and big firms. And it seems to me that in a small firm where you do have a lawyer being retained and assigning a lawyer to do the in-house things like the pleadings and schedules and all of that, and the small-town lawyer then is going to try the case after it's prepared, that does not seem to me to be much different from what happens in a big firm where, say, for example, I, as a senior lawyer, might assign a matter to a younger partner, trusting that younger partner to do the job, and then all of a sudden, after the fact, I find out that the younger partner goofed up and the judgment from my health care provider has been taken against the client. Now, somehow the OLR is saying that in a small firm where everybody knows what's going on, it's somehow different in a compartmentalized big firm. And I don't really think it is. And therefore, I think this court should be very careful as to how this responsibility under 5.1C2 is allocated among lawyers. I think if you go back to the rule where you look at the elements where the partner or has direct supervisory authority, that's usually met. But this business of knowledge and failure to take remedial action is part of the picture, and it has to be part of the picture. And that gets me back to my original thesis here, is that this is not a tort case based upon responsibility in the broad sense for damages. Rather, 5.1C2 has to be based on some moral judgment where these three elements are satisfied. And with respect to Owsley, Klopak, Ditter, and Krause, they weren't satisfied. OLR will tell you that, yes, he was asleep at the switch or these errors happened under his watch. But I don't think there's a difference as to who brings in the business. It depends on what the knowledge of that person is, because otherwise you're taking the rules of professional conduct and expanding them beyond the personal responsibility that lawyers have. Law firms are not liable under the rules. You won't find anything in the model rules that imposes professional liability on a lawyer. They're always on the individual lawyer who does something wrong. And many times, and this is one example of it, there has to be this element of knowledge and failure to rectify it.
What about 8.4A?
aid and assist violation, what is 824?
Violate or attempt to violate the rules, knowingly assist or induce another, or do so, violate a rule, do so through the acts of another. And that in the commentary says, apart from this rule, 20:5(1) and 84A, which I just read to you, then the lawyer doesn't have disciplinary liability. My problem in this case is the way this firm appears to be set up from the record, which is Mandelman gets the clients. Mandelman works them, and some clients know that he has others doing it, others don't know. The two of them work each of the files, sometimes one, sometimes the other. This was set up so that they're both responsible for this file and for how they deal with the client. Your brief keeps saying, well, Mandelman doesn't supervise his partner, and his partner doesn't supervise Mandelman. But the way this is set up, the way they're working together, you can't not have them reviewing each other's work and either explicitly or implicitly accepting the other's work.
Well, that may be true, but that's true in every law firm. And that's why I say that this court...
Not necessarily.
Well...
Not necessarily. It just depends on how the firm is set up and how the client is dealt with.
But many law firms, in fact, I would say, I can't say all law firms, but most law firms rely on some people to bring in the business and others to do the work. Now, I think...
But the business person doesn't always look and review the file or is not necessarily told that the business getter, the rainmaker, is going to personally handle it.
Well, if there is a problem in the sense that you're raising it, number one, my client was not charged with 8.4A.
Understand that.
And there is also the responsibility of a lawyer to communicate. That charge is creeps in here and there, but largely is ignored. What I'm asking this court to do is to look at the record and see if the 5.1C2 elements are met. And if they're not, my client should not be disciplined. And that's just the way the law is.
If your client is in charge of the file and deliberately doesn't check it out and work it, is it a violation of 20:5(1)(c)(2)?
No.
No.
Because, let me just be very practical, is what happened here. My client is out taking depositions, running all over the state, trying cases, and the other lawyer is the stay-in-the-office guy who does the pleadings. Now, if you're going to have an effective two-person firm, this is a pretty good business plan. It's a business plan, I think, that's prevalent throughout the state with two lawyer offices. Somebody's going to stay at home and somebody's going to be out in court. If you're in the middle of a five-day trial, or if you're out of town taking depositions, how are you going to daily check the file? How are you going to check to see that your in-house guy unfortunately misled a client and let a judgment be taken against him? It just is not really fair to put lawyers in this kind of position, particularly in a small firm.
How do you distinguish the Hicks case, which was the other case that involved this C2 provision? Two-member firm, the attorney who was the sub-attorney Hicks said that he was unaware of the conduct of the other attorney, Brown Perry.
Well, I think what Hicks did was he stipulated to a violation and this court approved it.
That's correct. But he asserted that he was unaware. But then ultimately he conceded after the referee was scheduled. he conceded the stipulation.
Sure. Well, if he stipulated to the violation, then he would have stipulated to that knowledge and failure to rectify.
I think the referee had made the findings in that case and public reprimand, and then he just stipulated and didn't contest it after the referee
yes.
had made the findings. And we adopted the findings and conclusions and,
right.
and the violation, two-member firm, one Hicks saying unaware. So that's the only other time, I think, that we used C-2, but it was seems like it's a comparable situation.
Well, C-2 is not been litigated very much, and I think OLR and yours truly here cited to the court all of the available cases. And you can see that most of them are pretty unusual, and, of course, we have Hicks. And I think that's why this case is so important.
Let's go to the bottom line. The bottom line is, as I understand it, OLR is asking for a year, the referee 9 months. What is it that you're asking the court to impose here?
Well, there were some violations here. Some of the violations were admitted. We cited the Converse case and the Bacchus case. Converse involved a lawyer who had been thrice disciplined and received 9 months. We don't believe that even if this court concludes that Mandelman is responsible under 5.1C2 that he should bear a heavier price than Reitz, who was actually guilty of most of the misconduct here.
And Reitz got, 5 months?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 months. The other thing
Reitz
is we
didn't have any prior misconduct.
That's true.
And I think this is the fourth time that Mr. Mandelman is in front of us, and he has in addition account with regard to tax, failing to file taxes.
Right. And let me dwell on the taxes a little bit. When this court reinstated Mr. Mandelman, there was concern about the taxes. And if you look at page where his tax lawyer testified, it's in the transcript at page 577, where after reinstatement, Mr. Mandelman saw to it that the IRS got about $1,600,000 from Mandelman. And as of the date I'm speaking, Mr. Mandelman has represented to me that all the state tax liabilities are paid. He could have run away from this. And his tax lawyer testified about some of the difficulties that were attendant in failing to file the tax returns because of the very complicated situation. And I would just simply refer you to pages 574 to 577 of the transcript. And ultimately, we have here is a lawyer who paid his taxes at great sacrifice. He could have gone bankrupt. And this court in the Lex case has disciplined lawyers with reprimands for that sort of thing. So we have here, yes, an admitted violation on the failure to file tax returns. We have a stipulation that there was no, concession by the OLR that there was no intent to deprive the government of its funds.
I just have a question. You talk about going bankrupt. Now, and you can enlighten me. Can you wipe out tax liability in bankruptcy?
I don't know if you can or not, but in any event.
I didn't think you could.
I think taxes are a priority, but I'm not in the estate, but I'm not, I think they're dischargeable, but I'm not representing that to the court.
I don't know that.
Yeah. I know they're a priority, but I don't think they're non-dischargeable. OLR judgments are non-dischargeable. I know that. But anyway, I think in fairness, given the history, and the other thing I'd just like to say is that what Mr. Mandelman was disciplined before are not really related to the kinds of things that are charged here. The bulk of this case is his failures with respect to Reitz, who has been disciplined, and we think that it's certainly appropriate for Mr. Mandelman to defend himself before this court and say that the elements of 5.1C2 were not satisfied here. But But our view of
it. Mr. Hildebrand, if I agree with you that the elements aren't satisfied, looking at the other violations in Mr. Mandelman's past record, I want to get back to Justice Bradley's bottom line. What is it you want us to do?
Well, our view is that this is a case where discipline ought to be imposed based upon the record and the admitted violations, and we think that a short suspension is probably the highest that this court should go.
What's short? No. Give me a number.
3 months.
Okay.
Like Converse. Who's, again, the fourth time before this court.
Okay.
Even if we don't, as I looked at it, I think C2 applied to counts, maybe four counts or three counts that weren't subject of dismissal. That is 9, 10, and 13. I think even if you take the OLR's dismissals and the referee's dismissals, I know OLR is contesting, I think, one of them. But if you take those as all final, and if you take your C2 argument, you're still left with violations of 1, 3, 6, 8, 11, and 12, it seems to me. You know, even if you would prevail on C2.
Well, I don't think the record would support violations on anything involving Kopech, Owsley, Ditter, and Kraus, and the tax violation is admitted. We presented our briefs and the argument about Ms. Crosby and all of that. There's really no reason for us to dwell on that in oral argument, but that basically is our position. And I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand. Mr. Krohn.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Krohn. It's an honor to be here. I'm retained counsel on behalf of Office of Lawyer Regulation. The counts that are appealed from here, some of them do turn on the partnership responsibility Supreme Court rule. And as I looked at this case and got away from it a little bit and then came back to it in preparation for this argument, it occurred to me as I looked at Mr. Mandelman's conduct, it was clear to me that his violations on his own, not even considering this rule, he violated the diligence, the communication with client, failure to explain matters, even if he didn't take into account this rule. Frankly, we did prosecute this case based on the 5.1C2 rule, and in all due respect to Mr. Hildebrand, who wasn't there, it wasn't treated like a malpractice case. It was treated like a case that represented a violation of that rule. Partnership responsibility and knowledge of one partner as to what another partner should be doing can be inferred. Knowledge can be inferred under the definitions and the rules.
Mr. Crum, can you focus with respect to that on count 9, please?
I'm sorry?
Count 9.
Count 9?
Count 9, yes, please. Show me where the knowledge aspect is met with respect to count 9. That's the one involving Kopech.
Okay.
That'll help you out.
All right. Well, Mr. Kopech, like all other clients, came to Mr. Mandelman, retained Mandelman and Reitz, but spoke with Mandelman and signed the retainer agreement. That's a common thread in all of these cases.
It seems Mr. in the Kopech, other case, the reason I'm asking the question is it seems in the other cases there were ongoing communications between Mandelman and the client. It seems, unless I'm misreading the record, that in count 9, the gist of the involvement of Mandelman was being he was the attorney that was hired, and then everything else seemed to fall on Reitz. And so I'm concerned about the knowledge aspect if there's no further communication between Kopech and Mandelman.
Well, Kopech, once things went south on the case in terms of the health care providers and in other respects, communicated with the Mandelman and Reitz office, talking to them, requesting a court date. Mandelman responded in the middle of the handling of this case in a letter of July 31 saying, confirming the conversation and concluding, quote, "We will do everything we can do to expedite this matter as quickly as possible on your behalf." That's a Kopech exhibit number 3. Kopech also sent a letter to Reitz and Mandelman complaining about these problems. And ultimately, a mediation session was handled by Mandelman. So you have, as the Chief Justice pointed out, not only Mandelman on the front end of the case, he's getting receiving complaints from this client as well as others about the status of the case, regardless of who's misperforming. He's reassuring the client, and ultimately he's going to be on the back end of the case mediating the case. So I think Mandelman's fingerprints, if you will, were all over these cases. I will concede in the Kopach case to a lesser extent than the others, but I think there's still responsibility.
So you're imputing knowledge from the facts that he's checking the files, he's been alerted, he writes letters, he then ultimately mediates. You're saying you infer from that he knows what's in the file and therefore is liable for it.
You certainly can. And the key here is this is a common client. This is a two-person law firm. In a law office, it's about the size of a tenth of this room. They have a common file drawer. They have a common client. They have a common purpose for that client, to maximize their recovery or to handle their employment case. It's a single client issue. They communicate one with another. Mandelman takes in the client. The client retains the firm, which is a two-person operation. Mandelman ultimately retains the right to mediate or try the case. Mandelman actually assigns some functions to Reitz. I think that there could be a suggestion that was supervision. I don't think we have to even get to supervision, because I think these are partners that have knowledge that can be inferred from all these circumstances as to what one another is doing. And you have situations here where these clients, two of them, were so frustrated they got online with the circuit court to find out the status of their own case. They couldn't find out from their attorneys. And then, when complaints are to be registered with the firm, these clients don't go back to Reitz. For instance, Ms. Dieter, in her case, after the fact, sent a long letter of complaints as to what happened, sent it to Mr. Mandelman. And the other interesting point about these cases is that what is the client's perception here?
Well, Mr. Crum, before you go there, let me express one of the concerns that I have about the 5.1 C2 argument. I think of a time in a prior life, long ago and far away, when I was a member of an agency, a public defender's agency. There's supervisory responsibilities that belong with that agency, and you have different attorneys who are assigned to handle specific cases, and there's supervisors that are assigned to handle, and or at least to supervise the various attorneys in the office. And sometimes complaints come into the office, and sometimes they go through the supervisors. And I'm always worried about scope of decisions and how a decision here might impact on that type of an agency setting.
Okay. Well, I think there are two key findings made here by the referee. One, that there was no testimony that the clients were told or knew that the lawyer's responsibility was separate and distinct from each other. And the second key finding that was that the clients were not informed that Mandelman was not responsible for Reitz's acts. So, just to conclude on this, I want to get to a couple other points. I think we've talked probably enough on this particular subject.
Excuse me. I know you want to move on, but I'm not sure you answered my question.
I'm not sure I understood your question. I thought you were just making a statement.
The concern is whether you're talking about a two-person office or a 150-person office.
Right.
There are supervisory duties that attenuate for various people within the office, and you have individual attorneys assigned to handle individual cases. And when we start applying 5.1 C2, my concern is how that might be viewed down the road in other cases involving, say, larger entities, state agencies, Attorney General's office, Public Defender's office. How are we going to apply this in terms of what the supervisor should have known, or what other attorneys in the office should have known or did know? And that's the concern that I have.
I think you would apply this standard on a case-by-case basis as necessary. If this were a 500-person law firm, and one attorney who handles patents only had a personal injury client come to him and assigned that personal injury client to another attorney only because he or she didn't know how to do work in that area, and they never interrelated again on the file or with the client, that attorney wouldn't be responsible should that case go south, should there be problems. That's not what we have here. And that's the only way I can answer that question.
Mr. Crohn, you were asked whether it's a no or should know. Now, the terminology which is defined in the SCR is knowingly, denote actual knowledge of the fact in question, not should have known, actual knowledge. Then the second sentence is, a person's knowledge may be inferred from circumstances.
Right.
So my understanding, your position here is that either man or woman knew, or that his actual knowledge can be, he denies knowing, but his actual knowledge can be inferred from the circumstances.
Correct.
And the circumstances being that some clients never knew he wasn't working on the case. The other clients did know that there were two lawyers. They were both involved in the case at various times. Therefore, both had access to and did review the files. Therefore, you're inferring knowledge. Is that?
Those are some of the factors. And in addition, some of these clients in the middle of the handling of the case went back to him and complained.
Okay. And which would lead you to think he's looking at the file.
Don't
and
you're
inferring knowledge.
I don't believe it when he says I knew nothing about what was going on in these files, to be quite blunt about it, but it doesn't seem to be an appropriate defense to say, I'm assigning it out, I'm going to keep my head in the sand here and tell me when it's time for me to come out of the sand and try the case. That's from a policy standpoint, I don't think that's the kind of rule we want here. So I dealt with the individual five client cases in some detail. Again, the perception of the clients is interesting because they all looked pretty much considered Mr. Mandelman their attorney. Mr. Wright's kind of popped in on these cases, and some of them thought he was one referred to him as a stand-in, and the only reason they communicated with Mr. Wright's was Ms. Krause said that she had a difficult, not an impossible time in communicating with Mr. Mandelman.
Well, the reason I ask the question is if you look at the findings of the referee, and I'm looking at findings 13 and 14, on page appendix 23 of Mr. Hildebrand's brief. Attorney Reitz conceded in his disciplinary action that he violated 20:1.3 in not keeping Mr. Kolpak informed with respect to the general clinic case. And then the finding is that Attorney Mandelman violated 20:1.3. I don't have any problems with that finding. But then, and section 20:5.1c2. Now, as I see that finding for Mr. Mandelman to be guilty of 20:5.1c2, he would either have to have actual or inferred knowledge of Mr. Reitz's violation.
That's correct.
So he would have to know that Mr. Reitz never communicated with Mr. Kolpak.
And it's a fair inference, I think, under the facts and the findings that he knew.
All right.
From the circumstances. And I'd like to turn, if I could, to the liability, the release question in this case, which frankly OLR considers to be the most serious violation. Mr. Mandelman, in an argument, was heard to say, well, he would never have tried to protect himself from liability with such a document because he was disciplined for having done so in 1990, I believe it was. My point is that, and OLR's point is that that suggests to us that this is a pattern of conduct for him. Having done it before, he tried it again. And he's saying, I didn't know about this release. All the facts and circumstances that the referee heard permitted him to reach a conclusion that he did know and is responsible. And what are those facts and what are those circumstances? You had a disgruntled client. Mr. Mandelman asked that this document be prepared, and the Chief Justice's comment that he wanted a document showing that the client was happy was something that just doesn't make any kind of sense at all. I don't know why an attorney would say that. If that were the case, he would have brought back a card or something expressing his happiness. In fact, a carefully constructed release from legal liability and from disciplinary responsibility was drafted, and protecting only Mr. Mandelman, not Mr. Reitz. Reitz carries the water, so to speak, as a condition for a taking of a deposition. He has his client on the same day sign the document. Now, members of the court, in light of the pattern of misconduct of Mr. Mandelman in other cases involving the same kind of violation, we think this is a very serious rule violation. And the referee's findings were not clearly erroneous. Likewise, on the contingent fee agreement issue, on the Crosby case and the malpractice case, there was no written contingent fee agreement. Mr. Mandelman said, well, I always have them, It's possible I didn't prepare one. He could not produce one. He produced his whole file. There was not one there. Ms. Crosby said she never saw such an agreement. She had no basis or reason to misstate that fact. And the court appropriately considered all those facts and concluded that one wasn't prepared. OR has also cross-appealed on but one count that was dismissed in this case, and that was the count dealing with the trust account deposit. In the Crosby case, Mr. Manneman received $3,000. At that point in time, although he had never billed for the case, he had generated fees of a portion of that amount, and he put those funds into his business account. No bill, no retainer agreement, and it was an advance towards future work. The referee, I think, just missed this point, and it is a point of law. It doesn't turn, it's not one of a discretionary point or credibility point. It's a question of law that this court, I think, can review de novo. And this court has said time and again, even before the new trust account rules, that these kinds of advance payments are the client's money and should have been put in trust. And I think the referee simply heard a witness on behalf of Mr. Manneman testify that there was great confusion amongst lawyers as to what to do with those kinds of funds at that time. We agree there was confusion, but there wasn't confusion with this court because the court's pronouncements on that subject were quite consistent. And those lawyer funds at that time, even though they were pre the 2004 trust account rule, required trust account deposit.
I read that this is under the cross appeal. This is the trust account rules is your cross appeal. Isn't that right? Okay.
Yes.
And I read the briefs, both yours and Mr. Hildebrand, and the various ethics opinions there. And it seemed to me the ethics opinions made clear that it depended on the intent of the parties. If the intent of the parties was to give money for costs expended previously or to give money for hours expended previously, then you could put it in your checking account. But if the intent was for future services, then you put it in your trust account. I mean, that's how I read all these ethics opinions. Am I reading them wrong?
I think that's what they say. And in this instance, there was not a written fee agreement saying that it was a non-refundable fee or anything. And I think it was agreed that Mr. Manneman was going to be charging on this matter by the hour. It's pretty much conceded that this was an advance for future services which required trust account treatment under those discussions of that rule at the time. Now, we like to be bottom line people too, and I guess I'll get to the bottom line in terms of sanction. We consider these to be very serious OLR regulatory violations, and the director of OLR has given us his recommendation that we think is quite reasonable, and we suggested a one-year suspension considering the severity of the violations and the number of them. The referee determined a nine-month suspension. We're not appealing that particular sanction recommendation of the referee, although it is somewhat less than what we had initially recommended. And our concern is the prior discipline here. Not only are there were 27 violations in 1990 leading to a one-year suspension of Mr. Manneman, largely dealing with neglect. And we have in this case neglect. Neglect by him, neglect by his partner. 1994, an 18-month suspension. Multiple violations including neglect, false statements, trust account violations. 1999, a private reprimand for making a false statement. A lot of these violations in this case fell shortly after Mr. Manneman was back in practice after these prior suspensions on a time-wise. Standing alone, these violations are serious. When one looks at them in a historical sense, in terms of this past conduct, in consideration of the number of violations, in consideration of the fact that many of these violations are very, very similar to what's happened before, for which he's been severely disciplined before, we think a long-term suspension is appropriate. Because we have here a pattern of neglect now covering from 1990 to 2000, well, till these violations. We have this effort to exonerate himself or to insulate himself from personal or ethical rule violations or personal liability is a dramatic example of disregard for this court's rules. So we stand by our sanction recommendation. I've jumped around a bit here, and I really have nothing further to add concerning my argument unless there should be further questions of the court.
You have a lot of charges here, a lot of counts, okay? What are your strongest counts, and would they, considering Mr. Mandelman's prior discipline record, would they justify 9 months? I mean, that's really a question for the court.
Well, I think so. I think if you took out the partnership liability matters that we've been talking about involving lots of neglect, we still have these very serious tax matters that were challenged at the time of the hearing, but then after the hearing they were stipulated to. There were multiple years of not filing taxes, but not actually asking for extensions of time to file taxes and not paying taxes. In violation of the standard in the Rogensack case. The agreement to limit liability, the contingent fee issue, and then the other charges that were not appealed by the plaintiff, I think in total, all of those charges, and considering the past history, warrant a minimum of a 9-month suspension. I'm not conceding for a moment that there isn't liability under 25.1C2 or that Mr. Mandelman, standing alone, even disregarding that rule, did not violate the diligence, keeping a client informed, statutes and other rules. So we stand by the 9-month to 1-year suspension recommendation, considering the history, and regardless of whether there are 9 violations or 7 or 6, In this case, the referee found of the 13 counts, 9 were violated, 4 were not. We appealed one of the findings that was found not to have been violated, and found the violations in the tax case, which I believe was 1 count. So there were 10 counts of violations total, and 1 count that was appealed that we think, as a matter of law, should be modified by this court so that the law is clear on that subject, and we don't have a referee's opinion out there suggesting that at that time attorneys could take an advance for fees for hourly work and put it in their business account. I think that's inconsistent with what this court's done before.
Are there any other questions of Mr. Crone?
Thank you.
None? Thank you, Attorney Crone. Mr. Hildebrand?
Mr. Crone cited the referee's findings, and I believe they're on page appendix 28 of my brief, all of which are correct, that in particularly he focused on the finding that Mandelman never informed his clients that he would not be responsible for actions taken by Reitz and that they would have to look to Reitz for whatever he did on their case. This is straight out of malpractice. Of course Mandelman didn't tell his clients that he wouldn't be responsible if there was some kind of malpractice. And I'd like to go back to the Kolpak case, which was raised in one of the questions. The reason that the referee wants recommended discipline on Mandelman is that one of these health care providers took a judgment against Kolpak. Well, that really was a side issue because Kolpak was pursuing a personal injury case. Again, we get back to this problem of knowledge. And I think this court, when it looks at the release issue with Ms. Crosby, on page two of my combined brief, the gray covered one, we find that Crosby was a very angry woman. She had a history of making threats and filing grievances, and he was concerned about it. In fact, in the record at Exhibit 30, there's an injunction prohibiting Crosby from threatening violence and stalking the guardian ad litem in her divorce custody case. I mean, this This was not your typical client, and Mr. Crone said that she was a difficult client, and I agreed that she was a difficult client.
Well, can you get a release from a difficult client?
Well, of course not. I mean, we're not.
Then why do you want a happy letter? What's the point of getting a happy letter?
I really can't answer that question very well, but that's what he wanted. But there's no evidence that he instructed or wanted a release. Now,
if you told me that one unhappy letter, I might draft a release. Or I might draft something that, in effect, binds the client.
Well, it was an unfortunate.
Sue me.
Right. It was an unfortunate.
That was the point.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That was the point. That's
well,
what I wanted.
This whole thing was a very unfortunate thing, and it results in an error of judgment. But to put things in context, that and the tax issue, and I'll take you back to the Lex case where there's a failure to file for 4 years, I believe, in Lex where this court issued a reprimand. I mean, to take these two things.
Any prior?
Pardon? I don't believe so. But here again, there's a big difference between a reprimand and a short suspension and a 9-month suspension, and we completely disagree, and I've outlined this in the brief, that these are different things. Mr. Crone talks about neglect. There isn't a 1.1 violation in this record. It wasn't even charged. I don't know what he's talking about. So, it's true, some of these clients were neglected, and Reitz was disciplined for it. But Mandelman was a very busy guy at the time, and some errors like this are unfortunate, but what I'm saying is they do not justify a lengthy suspension.
Mr. Hildebrand, you don't contest that Mr. Mandelman, in the COPAC matter, has violated Rule 1.3, the diligence in failing to keep COPAC advice, correct?
Yes, we do contest that. Because what the referee found in COPAC was where the violation was, is that this judgment in the general clinic case was entered. There's absolutely nothing in this record that Reitz had anything to do with what essentially was a side problem in the case. The COPAC was a personal injury client.
Yeah, I guess my question is a little bit differently. For me, at least, I see a difference between whether or not Mr. Mandelman is responsible for Mr. Reitz's actions as a supervisor partner versus whether Mr. Mandelman has a separate duty as being the attorney hired in the action to keep Mr. COPAC informed and to stay on top of the case. They're two different things. So for me, I see a difference between 1.3 and 5.1c2.
Well, you're correct. You're absolutely correct on that. There is a difference.
Mr. Mandelman was hired to represent Mr. COPAC, was he not?
That's right. But not to have diligence, was Mr. Mandelman supposed to know that COPAC talked to Reitz and said, I've got someone who sued me and I want you to do something about it, and Reitz doesn't do it, doesn't answer the complaint in time or whatever, and how is that a lack of diligence on Mr. Mandelman's part? Well, yes, he's responsible for malpractice, but, you know.
Count 9, the finding was that Mr. COPAC informed both Attorney Reitz and Mandelman about the creditor's actions. That's finding 10.
The finding doesn't say exactly when that happened or what the circumstances were. There's a lot of confusion in this record because the referee will say Reitz and Mandelman did this and that. Is he talking about the firm or is he talking about them as individuals?
I don't know, Your Honor.
I really don't.
I just know what the finding is. The finding is that the client who hired Mandelman was unhappy and then he talked with, then he informed Attorney Reitz and Mandelman about the creditor's actions, and then Attorney Reitz informed Mr. COPAC that he would take care of these credit matters. That's what the findings were anyway.
Right. Okay. So the client informs Reitz and Mandelman both of this, and Mandelman says to Reitz, look, will you take care of this? Reitz says he will, and he doesn't. Should Mandelman be disciplined for that? I don't think so. Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand, and thank you, Mr. Cronin, for your arguments in this lawyer regulation case, 03AP3348D and 04AP2633D. And that ends our hearing on this case. The students will remain. And are you able to remain for about 10 minutes? The majority are shaking their heads, yes. So Mr. Justice Wilcox will come out and talk with you for a short, brief time, and then we will move on to our second case this morning. We are in recess, except...